You know, the United States Bay of Pigs decision ranks as one of the worst fiascos ever recorded by a sensible human government. Planned by an overambitious group of American intelligence officers, John F. Kennedy, with the consensus of his cabinet, gave the go-ahead to secretly place over 1,000, closer to 1,500 Cuban exiles at the southern end of Cuba in April of 1961. Now, I have to be honest here, this is 4 years before I was born. Some of you remember this. This is going to be real familiar territory. It was this brigade that was responsible for overthrowing the individual who had taken command, taken responsibility, taken the helm of Cuba, that being Fidel Castro and his new communist government. Regrettably, as historians note, the plan was so flawed that it was an abysmal failure right from the start. If you don't know much about the Bay of Pigs decision, or if it's been a little while since you've gotten familiar with it, here's an abbreviated version of how it actually came to pass. In March of 1960, President Dwight D. Eisenhower, acting on Vice President Richard Nixon's suggestion, actually directed the Central Intelligence Agency to organize a collection of Cuban exiles for a political overthrow of the newly established Cuban government. Just 2 days after Kennedy's inauguration, Kennedy was then briefed on the proposed plan in order to overthrow Castro. For the next 3 months, then, Kennedy, with his cabinet members, had meeting after meeting in order to determine whether they should invade. He also included separate meeting with the three joints of staff. And it was then at a certain point in April that he gave the go-ahead to invade. Particularly, it was April 17th of 1961. And for April 17th to April 19th, when that invasion was to occur successfully, the reality is that nothing went as planned. In reality, every step that the American government took, for whatever reason, Castro seemed to know in advance what they were going to do and how to cut it off. You know, while multiple ships containing supplies and reserve ammunition were launched to support the overthrow, Castro's military either blocked the ships or they sunk them. And while the brigade of Cuban exiles indeed did make the beach, the exiles were immediately surrounded. Remember, we're dealing with numbers here, roughly 1,400 to 1,500. In fact, one source offered 1,400, one offered 1,500, a later count, 1,512. Men, they were surrounded, you ready for this? By 75,000 Cuban military men. Of those who actually made the beach, it wound up that 114 were killed, 400 were lost, that was a category that separately was noted, and the remainder were actually forced at gunpoint to march to prison camps. Historians report that the consequences of Kennedy's decision plagued him the rest of, as we now know, his short life. And yet, and additionally, many others would speak that there were times, even with Kennedy, that he would stop those around him, and he would pause, and he would wonder out loud how this responsible, rational government could make such a poor, ill-starred decision. It really plagued him. You know, while there were many reasons why the invasion would have fallen, careful consideration by historians and researchers alike actually reveal a subtle flaw in the reasoning that prompted Kennedy to go ahead with the invasion. And that's what I'm going to ask that we talk about today. Because this one singular flaw that sometimes we minimize will actually prevent you and me from entering the kingdom of God if we don't keep our hearts and our minds aware of its potential. You know, we really find the roots of this fatal flaw in a couple of verses. I'm going to go to the book of Proverbs, and we're going to read, 16:25, but they say the same thing. Proverbs 16:25, by background, is a reminder of how short-sighted human beings are. Proverbs 16:25 reads this way: "There's a way that seems right to a man," and we could add woman here, but its end is the way of death. There are times when we can be so convinced of something. We know and we feel it to our core and our bones, and the reality is we can be dead wrong. And 16:25 reminds us of that. Proverbs 26:12. A second verse, Proverbs 26:12. Again, this kind of gives you some sense of why Kennedy would make such a bad decision. Proverbs 26, verse 12. Do you see a man wise in his own eyes? The question that's offered. There is more hope for a fool than for him. I get a laugh out of Mr. Bryan over there. So I ask in advance, and this doesn't aim to be unfair. I ask in advance before we go into this, because we'll talk about some of the background details of why Kennedy made the decision. Do you know what the flaw is? Now, I'll just kind of provide a rhetorical question there, because I think some of the details here will really tease out something that'll point to a flaw that we oftentimes fall prey to if, as I've already said, we don't give unique, special attention. That said, there are really four pieces of information that we need to address in order to clarify why Kennedy chose to invade Cuba. And I'm not going to go long on them. I want to address them ever so briefly. Those four sections are the makeup of Kennedy's cabinet, the plan for invasion, the state of Cuba at the time, and then lastly, the mindset of Kennedy's cabinet. Because these elements will give us some indication as to why Kennedy actually made this poor decision. So let's first of all talk about Kennedy's cabinet. And I'm going to show you a picture of them. And you can probably see there, right in the middle of the picture on the right-hand side, there's John F. Kennedy. And if you go back and read historically, or if you're one who read the papers at the time and followed this, you were well aware of the members of that cabinet. I won't go through all of them, except I will say that at the time, many of those individuals who sat on that cabinet were widely recognized as the most intelligent minds of the time. If I just name a couple of them, Harvard historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. was on that cabinet. Past president of Ford Motor Company and the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, was on that cabinet, as was Bobby Kennedy. You can see him down here on the bottom, and a range of other individuals. And, of course, there was John F. Kennedy. Now, by background, we know that Kennedy was really an amazing figure. From the vantage point of he wasn't really viewed as potentially being president for a range of factors, in part because of his Catholicism, but a number of other factors that, against all odds, he seemingly overcame in order to win the presidency. But as we look at these individuals quickly, it's helpful to note that, again, this was a learned bunch. They were well-schooled. They were widely recognized as level-headed. And so in a case like this, as we look at them, this was not necessarily just a group thrown together. They were actually a very smart crew. Now, the next slide, if it helps here, and Mr. John Beam was pointed in this. He said, I spent a whole lot of time trying to read your slide. The aim is not for you to read it, but just to understand the details. It's helpful to understand the plan that they arrived at originated by the CIA. And that plan really had five steps, and you can probably read some of the details here and the timeline. But if I go through briefly what the plan is, this is what the Kennedy's cabinet discussed over this three-month period of time. The first thing that they believed they were going to do was they were going to bring to the beach this group of Cuban exiles. Now, by definition, if it helps, these happen to be Cubans who had gotten out of Cuba. They had come to the U.S. They were widely recognized as disliking or opposed to what was happening with the Cuban government, and they were ready to go to war over it. So this group of 1,500 were actually well-trained. And so they were to, step one, to be secretly brought to shore, the southern end. If I go back two slides. Okay, you can see Guantanamo Bay down here at the bottom and Havana. And then that little, can I get it? Yeah, right there. That's what they were after. They were going to beach them right there, and they had long thought about this in order to progress well. So that was step one. We have to get them to the beach. Step two was that they would then receive air support, principally from the U.S. Air Force. And I'll get into some details there. The third thing is that they were told that they would be part of a multi-pronged invasion. They would be a small part of a whole. So those exiles, once beached, would have support from a variety of different sources. Four, the exiles would then defeat Castro's army, because the common knowledge, at least among Kennedy's cabinet, was that those around Castro, and Castro specifically, was really a buffoon. How smart could this guy be? After all, he's Cuban. I mean, literally, that was how the language ran in those cabinet meetings. Step five was that the exiles' action would, at some point, once they got into some of those bigger areas, those bigger metropolis areas, would actually create a coup of Castro's government. They would actually overthrow it. And then if everything failed, if I go back two slides, if for whatever reason nothing worked, the Cuban exiles would then drop down, and I'll see if I get this right, they would drop down to this mountain range, because they knew that there were some Cuban dissenters that were in that mountain range, and then they would remain there, and eventually the U.S. would come and pick them up. So that's the plan. So how did this plan go? Well, as you probably figure out, it didn't go well. To put it succinctly, the Cubans were ready for them. Now, here's to what degree they were ready for them, if you didn't know this. They had already caught wind of an invasion. To such an extent, they were printing details of the invasion on the front pages of their newspapers. You could go and pick up a Cuban newspaper at that time and find out that you were going to be invaded. Shock of shocks. The British intelligence had passed this on to our government, and this was brought up multiple times in those cabinet meetings along the way. Secondly, Castro, as well, was well aware of this. And in doing so, in anticipation of this, he had gone to his buddies, the Soviets. Now, why had he done this? Because he wanted air support. And so he had gone to the Soviets, and he had asked for their latest fighter jets. And he had also asked for their best pilots to come over and train the Cubans to fly those jets. Sure enough, they had gotten those fighter jets down into Cuba. They had been training them, and they were well aware, well versed in how to fly those planes. Now let's go to the other side of the ledger, because the U.S. thought at that time that they could provide air support using old World War II planes. This is what they did. In fact, if you go back, one of the things that they did is they actually took the stars and stripes and any markings off of those planes, so no one would be able to detect that they were providing air support, or the air support was coming from the U.S. Now, as you already figured out, if you have the latest fighter jets versus old World War II planes, there is no match. And indeed, that was a failure on our part as well. You know, while as I already noted here, the exiles were also told that they were one part of the invasion, the reality or the truth was that they weren't. They were the invasion. Those 1,500 men were actually viewed by Kennedy's cabinet and by Central Intelligence as the only means of invading and overthrowing Castro in Cuba. This came up in those discussions. Further to their surprise, what they found is not a bunch of hooligans. They actually found an incredibly well-trained fighting force. And I offer this picture because Castro had taken those 75,000 troops, and he had run them through the rigors of war. And he had them well-placed, anticipating the invasion where it happened. So it was nothing like what happened in those discussions in the cabinet meetings. You know, while the exiles were told that they could then motivate a coup, the reality is that Castro at the time had actually been really good to the Cuban people after taking over the leadership duties. In fact, he had gone to extra measures. In times past, they necessarily hadn't had good jobs. They certainly hadn't had enough food. They hadn't had money. He had taken several steps in order to provide them food, to provide them jobs, and to take further action so the people loved him. He knew how to win them over. You know, the shame of it all is that the Cubans were not going to overthrow Castro. And again, this came up in the discussions among those on Kennedy's cabinet. The last item I need to offer here, because someone on the cabinet forgot to go and look at a map. And here's why I say that. Because if we go back, and I'll go back here, one of the things that came up, remember I talked about how they had a 5-point plan that if all 5 steps worked, they would indeed effectively invade Cuba. And if none of this worked, step 6 was that you would run and hide in the mountains. Okay, so here's the problem. See how this map has a couple of colors here? There's a lighter green, and there's this other green. Okay, if they landed anywhere in here, they were told to run to the mountains. Now, here's our mountains, the Escambria Mountains. Now, someone forgot to tell them that this was tens of miles away, and they would have to cross swampland that at times went up to your chest and your neck in order to do so. So as the discussions wind up, the transcripts from many of those cabinet meetings show, and interviews after the fact, they had no hope of if it was a failure of holding up in the mountains. That said, as you can begin to see here, that swampland prevented them from successfully hiding out. You know, it was years later that records indicate that most of the details regarding what took place in Kennedy's cabinet showed flaw after flaw after flaw in decision making. Those on Kennedy's cabinet believed sincerely that the U.S. was too great a superpower to fail, number one. Number two, they believed that Castro was really too much of a buffoon to prevail. They weren't convinced that Castro was smart enough to stop them. And then thirdly, they were really viewed John F. Kennedy as a golden child. And indeed, at that time, much of this nation did. They believed him too smart, too adept to make a bad decision. So what wound up happening in the dynamics of those meetings over and over as they went round and round is really a dysfunctional process. You know, I first came across this story having read the work of Irving Janis, and he got to talking about the fatal flaw of reasoning that oftentimes humans fall into. And what he offers here in pretty thorough research is that this faulty decision-making really fell prey to 3 things. It was a product of Kennedy oftentimes in those meetings only speaking of the advantages of invasion. He would never address the disadvantages because he didn't want to hear them. So they would have these meetings. He would only take comments that he believed to be in support of the idea. That's a shortcoming. Kennedy also would only call on those individuals, and he had Bobby, his brother, go and check on this. Bobby would go and ask these different individuals. He would only call on those individuals who agreed with him. And then thirdly, and this was an interesting dynamic that Kennedy oftentimes held to, is he would take a straw poll in order to establish consensus in that cabinet. And that straw poll oftentimes involved the following. He would start at an individual he knew would be in support of the invasion, and he would say, "Arthur Schlesinger, what do you think?" And Schlesinger would say, "I think that's a good idea." And then Kennedy would move around the table a certain direction of people who would also be in support of it. And if he got 3, 4, 5, 6 yeses, and the next person he thought would be a no, he would stop the straw poll and say, "Look, obviously we're all in support of this invasion, so we have to go forward with it." Now again, the transcripts and the reports afterward indeed prove this out. So here's where Janis comes in, and he looks at all of this, based upon the research, a historical analysis, and he says, here's the fatal flaw, and it's one that human beings oftentimes fall into. It's one where those on the cabinet, desirous of pleasing John F. Kennedy, just fell prey to conformity. Conformity. Now, that one I didn't see coming. Conformity. Maybe I should be asking, is that what you thought it was? It certainly wasn't me whenever I first read the research. You know, researchers went in and began to look at this, and they looked at it a number of different ways, and they said that in many cases there, the individuals wanted to be supportive of Kennedy. And even naysayers who wanted to be supportive of Kennedy wouldn't make a statement. And what we had was an interesting dynamic where there was an inevitable move to invade despite all the evidence to the contrary. So maybe we should be asking, well, what is conformity? Well, if you go to any standard dictionary today, standard dictionaries, Webster's, dictionary.com, pretty much define conformity the same way. They say that conformity is adhering to a decision or standard, adhering to a decision or standard, complying with an attitude or practice. It was Jay Mann in 1969 who actually said the following about conformity. It is the essence of yielding to group pressure. Yielding to group pressure. And that's what those individuals did. Sam McLeod, years later, actually said the following further about conformity. It's an agreement to the majority position brought about either by a desire to fit in or a motivation to be liked or because of a desire to be correct or conform to a social role. So maybe we should be asking ourselves, what are the different ways that we conform? Well, conformity shows up all over the place. Conformity shows up in the way we dress. Conformity shows up in the way we act. Conformity shows up in the way in what we say. It involves buying into thoughts and actions all around us. Society is based upon conformity, if we really think about it. And certainly conformity has a certain degree of benefits. I get that. We wind up with peace. No one sticks out if you conform. There's really nothing to make us different. Yet it also has tremendous limitations. You know, I'll give you an example of one instance where I actually succumbed, and I probably succumbed more often than I would ever hasten to admit. But that said, in 1989, I went to summer camp, Orr, Minnesota, for the first time. Lived in Detroit, Michigan. Hadn't lived there for a long time. The Browns were there. I was a 14-year-old young guy. I wanted to fit in. We had moved to Detroit shortly thereafter. You know, we had intended to move to Portland, Oregon, but that one didn't pan out. So we wound up moving to Detroit. And shortly after there, I was set to go to SCP Orr. And so I got to camp, and I was a 14-year-old kid. We spent 3 weeks at summer camp at that time. And one of the things I wanted to do was fit in. A little bit shorter, a little bit slower, a little bit heavier than I would like to be. And I just did all I could to try and fit in with the bigger kids, the kids who were a little more athletic. And they began to kind of sense this. And one of the things that they would do sometimes is they would say, "Hey, Oz, you know, we're going to go do something. You want to try this?" And sometimes I would say no. And for whatever reason, on this one instance, I said yes. It was a bad decision. They wanted to go cliff jumping. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever gone cliff jumping up or around Minnesota or the Boundary Waters. Really is pretty amazing, especially when you do it right. And they weren't talking about doing it right. They were about taking me with four other guys cliff jumping off the camp grounds. And we would walk about 30 to 40 minutes. This was by light of the moon, so it was about 2 a.m. because we had to sneak out. And they said, "Well, you got to go cliff jumping with us." So I said, "Sure." So I put on my tennis shoes, and when they tapped me at 2 a.m., and I went with them. And next thing you know, after this 30, 40-minute walk and coming through brush, we found ourselves at the edge of a cliff looking down, probably, I would guess, about 40 feet. And I thought, how did I get myself into this? Why am I here? I guess instinctually it was, I just want to fit in. I just want to be accepted by these older kids. So the one oldest kid kind of backed us up, and he said, "I'm going first," and he took off running, and he jumped off. And then the second guy, this sounds like a joke, it's not a joke. Then the second guy lined up, and he took off. And next thing you know, I had four guys who'd gone, and I'm standing there, and they're yelling at me, "Come on, Austin, you got to jump." So there was all these parts of me, all the internal, you know, the butterflies and everything else, scared to death, afraid to run. And so I backed up, and the last thing they yelled to me is, "Run really fast and hard when you go." And I ran really fast and hard, threw myself off the side of that cliff. Again, by estimates, I have no idea. It took a while, I know, before I hit the water. But hit the water, landed, and then as I swam back, because we were just off the shore, I swam back about 3 feet and realized that the rock surface was only about a foot underwater. And so I had been fortunate enough to jump just far enough, probably to not break my back. Now, I had no idea of that. So then what did I do again to fit in as I climbed that rock surface up? In fact, I think we climbed it about 4 or 5 times. You probably guess I was motivated to jump a lot further. Jump further. We did all this, probably 3 a.m. Nothing but the moonlight. There wasn't anything else out there. And then we walked back. Now, I don't tell this story to you because I'm proud of it. I'm actually ashamed that I did that. I made a bad decision. That was a terrible decision. It was a product of me wanting to fit in. Me wanting to conform. You know, I'm reminded of the Nobel Prize winner and poet Anatole France, who actually is credited as saying, if 50 million people say a stupid thing, it's still a stupid thing. If 50 million people do a stupid thing, it's still a stupid thing. If 50 million people act unrighteously, it's still unrighteousness. The number of people who do something doesn't change anything regarding something being right or wrong. And that's the danger of conformity, whether it be a cabinet meeting or whether it be a nation. If it helps, God has something to say on conformity, and I was reminded of that even last Sabbath with Mr. Burns' message. Go with me, if you will, to 1 Peter. God is quite pointed about the danger of conformity. 1 Peter 1, and in 1 Peter 1, we're going to begin reading in verse 3. 1 Peter 1, verse 3. It starts with verse 1, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ. And there's this moving verse 2, and I'll let you read that. Verse 3, blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled and that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you, who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time. In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. We get this incredible sense of what God will provide us as we are tried and true and faithful. And we don't conform. And then if we drop to verse 13, it says this, therefore, gird up your loins, the loins of your mind. Be sober and rest your hope fully upon the grace that is brought to you at the revealing, the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, here's this word, not conforming ourselves to the former lusts as in your ignorance. We happen to live in one of the most lustful societies in existence, in the scope of humanity. He says, don't you dare conform. 15, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in your conduct. Verse 16, because it is written, be holy, for I am holy. You know, as I was reading this, I got to thinking about the fact that where does conformity start? Maybe this is not a surprise and you're way ahead of me, but we have to go back to Isaiah 14. Because there was someone that was not convinced the way God was doing things was right. Isaiah 14. We'll just read a couple of verses here and then I'll quote a couple of others. Isaiah 14, 12 through 14. By background here, we know we're talking about Lucifer, the light bringer. And we see this language, and for whatever reason, he's not convinced that his lot in life is enough. And in verse 12, it reads, Isaiah 14, how you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of the congregation. On the farthest side of the north, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. That's what he wanted. He wanted to knock God off his throne. Now, we see a couple of other locations that I'll just reference. Luke 10, verse 18, where it's noted there by Luke that Satan was cast to earth. Remember, like lightning? He was thrown to earth. God said, I'm not dealing with this. I don't care what agenda you have. It doesn't work here. And we also see from Revelation 12, verses 3 and 4, that Satan was able to get one-third of the angels, as we heard referenced in the first message, to follow him. You know, the shame of it all is, if you go to Ephesians 2, is that same Satan, if I can offer this, the God of conformity is still working today. Ephesians 2, verse 2. This is a memory verse. I'll go there to read it specifically again so we see the text as well as hear the text. Ephesians 2, verse 1. And you he made alive, who were dead in trespasses and sin, in which you once walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. You know, one of the things that we recognize is that if we deal with conformity, there comes a point when people start buying in. If you go all the way back to Adam and Eve, Satan has been on a mission to coax conformity to all who've ever lived. While we might think of ourselves immune to this, we're not. Satan has always been there to highlight the benefits of conforming. Satan has always been there to manipulate the thoughts, minds, and attitudes of those around us. Satan has always been there taking a straw poll so that he only has those sides, those voices that support dissension so that you buy in. His methods are so secret and so clandestine that we often, well, many do, will actually deny his existence. And if you bring up the subject, you're ridiculed. Yet the reality is that God knows the danger of conformity. You know, I was thinking to myself a number of different stories in Scripture that illustrate well what conformity is. And for whatever reason, I found myself back in the book of Numbers. I'm going to ask you to go with me there. Numbers is an interesting book because impulsively, what I oftentimes think of Numbers is the numbering of Israel. And yet we see here where there's this record that Moses is inspired to write. And what is originally 11-day journey turns into 40 years. That's pretty amazing. You can turn 11 days into 40 years, but this is what winds up happening. And as we read Numbers, we see in Numbers 12 this incident regarding Aaron, Miriam, and Moses, questioning Moses. As we go to Numbers 13 and 14, remember this? We get an account of the spies who go and seek out the land of Canaan, the promised land. Remember how that works? Joshua and Caleb are there, and they go in with the spies, and they come back. Remember that cabinet dynamic, if I can use that language, where Joshua and Caleb come back and they go, we can take the land. It's plenteous. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. And we get 10 others that say what? We can't take that. That's craziness. We're as grasshoppers in their eyes. There's no way we can even involve ourselves in this. And we wind up with a whole generation that is lost, based upon that account, with the exclusion of two individuals, Joshua and Caleb. It's not those examples that I want to look at. I'm actually going to go to Numbers 16. And it's there in Numbers 16 that, again, we see the danger of conformity play out. I'm going to start in Numbers 16, verse 1, and we'll read several sections here. We'll move our way up to 33. I won't hit every verse, but I want to hit some highlights. If you want to start about, let's go in verse 2. We're going to deal with Korah. There are three other major players in verse 1, if it helps. Verse 2, and they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders. Wow, 250. Hold up here a second. I thought we were only dealing with four. Nope, they were good at getting people to conform. They got a whole lot of others to buy in. And they weren't necessarily pulling from the dregs. These weren't the losers they were pulling from, if you read by language. These happened to be leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation. Language here, notice, men of renown. Those who would buy in. Verse 3, and they gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, you take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the congregation of the Lord? How dare you, Moses? And Moses heard it, and he did that thing that oftentimes hurts. He fell on his face. And he spoke to Korah and all the company, saying, tomorrow morning the Lord will show you who is his and who is holy. And we see by background here where he goes through all this. And God and Moses have this conversation about the danger. And if you remember by background, and I'll just summarize storyline here, Moses says, you go get your censers because you're Levites, you're prominent, you're the educated. Remember, the Levites were the ones who were learned. You go get your censers and I'll get my censers and we'll come back and we'll let God decide this. Verse 15, then Moses went away very angry, and he said to the Lord, do not respect their offering. I have not taken one donkey. The Lord knows this, and Moses is pleading his case from them. Nor have I hurt one of them. And Moses said to Korah, tomorrow you and all your company be present before the Lord, you and they as well as Aaron. Each of you take his censer and put incense in it, and each of you bring this censer before the Lord, 250 censers. You also and Aaron, and each of you with his censer. So if it helps here by picture, and you've already figured this out, if we were to line them up in this room, we'd have two on this side and 250 on the other side. Who are you going with if you're Israelites? Well, it looks like the majority would work here. Wouldn't you think that 250 would outstrip the two? There's a danger in conforming. Verse 18, so every man took his censer and put fire in it, laid incense on it, and stood at the door of the tabernacle of meeting with Moses and Aaron. And Korah gathered all the congregation against them at the door of the tabernacle meeting. Then the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, separate yourselves from among the congregation, that I may consume them in a moment. Then they fell on their faces and said, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin, that being Korah, and you be angry with all the congregation? So the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the congregation, saying, get away from the tents of Korah and Dathan and Abiram. Now, there is a certain point here, you would guess, that even as Moses and Aaron heard this, and as the people heard this, there had to be the sickest feeling in the pit of their stomach. Because if God is saying, get away from them, you know, this is kind of close to what we heard in that first message. If God is saying, get away from them, there is not going to be a good end. Verse 26, then Moses rose and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him, and he spoke to the congregation, saying, depart now from the tents of these wicked men. Touch nothing of theirs, lest you be consumed in all their sins. You almost get a sense, if they were still in their tents, that they could hear this. Those tents aren't like brick walls. They probably heard some of this and thought, who are we kidding? We got 250 in support here. What's the big deal? 27, so they got away from around the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the door of their tents with their wives, their sons, and their little children. Then Moses said, by this you shall know the Lord has sent me to do all these works, for I have not done them of my own will. If these men die naturally like all men, or if they are visited by the common fate of all men, then the Lord has not sent me. But if the Lord creates a new thing, you ready for this? And the earth opens up its mouth and swallows them with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into the pit, then you will understand that these men have rejected the Lord. Then it came to pass as he finished speaking all these words, the unthinkable happened. The ground split apart under them, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households, and all the men with Korah with all their goods. So they and all those with them went down alive into the pit. The earth closed over them, and they perished from among the congregation. You know, there are times whenever I think about this, maybe in modern day Hollywood terms, and you get a sense of opening and all of these people falling, you know, the arms flailing as they fall and the tents going down. And then just as sure as they never existed, the ground closes up. And they were done. That fast. You know, we see in this case a horrible consequence of people conforming to one man, Korah. God makes clear here and elsewhere that we are not to conform. What then are we supposed to do? Well, I have two verses. Romans 12. I'll make sure I go to Romans 12 this time. Romans 12. This morning I was reading Romans 2 and it didn't sound right. Thankfully they were bearing with me. Romans 12, verse 1. Romans 12 provides us the exact opposite of conforming. Romans 12, verse 1. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And then in verse 2, and then we'll backtrack and we'll deal a little bit with what's actually being said here. And do not be conformed to this world. This world spends its time, society spends its time, Satan spends his time getting us to conform. But be, here's this other word, transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. You know, I went and looked up the language here for transform. Strong's Concordance actually says, to transform is to change into another form. Well, that's not a surprise. But the root word here is to metamorphose, is to actually change who we are. And I'll give you an example. That's a great example of what we're talking about here. God actually says, I expect you to change. From the point of baptism and the commitment you make to me, I expect change and progress. So how does this happen? Well, as we see here, by the renewing of our minds. Here's where Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says the following, that mere outward change is not enough. Conforming to this world is not enough. What we're asked here to do is to actually change our thoughts, to change our hearts, to change our motives. When we do so, we are actually, by language, if you look here, prove, the word prove it shows up here, we're actually proving that God's way works. One commentary actually said, we are an ongoing experiment. Because our experiences actually confirm that what God says is right. And it's when we do these things that we are pleasing to God. When we do those things that are right, it is pleasing to God. That means that we are required to be close to Him. That means we are required to listen to Him. And that listening happens by Bible study. We are required to talk with Him through prayer. And that can happen on our knees and in other ways throughout our days. And we're required to show fruit through our actions. We are called not to conform, but to transform, to change like a butterfly changes. When we do these things, we actually place ourselves on a path to the perfection, the completeness that's spoken of in Matthew 6:48. Become you therefore perfect. It doesn't happen by fiat. It's not a snapping of the fingers and all of a sudden we're changed. Baptized and changed. That's not how it works. It is working every day, sometimes through incredible anguish, to make little strides forward. Now, we can't neglect one part of the equation here, and I'm going to ask you to go to Galatians 1, verse 4. Because in this, even our greatest desires cannot remove the sins, the transgressions that keep us from the transformation possible. That only happens by Christ's sacrifice. And so Galatians 1 verse 4 says this. I can read in verse 3. It says, grace to you and peace from God and the Father and our Lord Jesus Christ, who gave himself for our sins and he might deliver us from this present evil age. This age of conforming, according to the will of our God and Father, to whom be glory forever and ever. Amen. You know, the only way this happens is by the blood of Christ wiping us clean and us starting new every day. And over time, if you turn to 2 Corinthians 3:18, over time, incrementally, day by day, dedicating ourselves to God, there is then transformation. 2 Corinthians 3:18. 2 Corinthians 3:18. I'll read in verse 17. Now the Lord is the Spirit. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty or freedom. Verse 18, 2 Corinthians 3:18. But we all, with unveiled face, beholding as in a mirror the glory of God, are being transformed into the same image from glory to glory, just as by the Spirit of the Lord. What we see in Scripture over and over, and we read it multiple times, is that we're not a people to conform. We are a people to transform. And the only way that happens, if we spend every day as active participants, as part of this calling, growing in the way God expects us to grow. Thereby, I entitled this message, A Call to Transform. We are called to transform. On April 17, 1961, John F. Kennedy, based on the consensus of his cabinet, launched 1,500 Cuban exiles in what became known as the Bay of Pigs on the south coast of Cuba. While on the surface, the idea seemed like it had merit, we now know that it was the way that Kennedy manipulated the intelligence provided him, the way he fostered the decision to invade, that really led to a monumental low in U.S. history. In short, historians and researchers point to the faulty reasoning of conformity. God tells you and me not to conform. He says, don't go there. Don't conform to this world. But our responsibility is to do the opposite, to transform by the renewing of our mind. This happens by the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. This happens by our baptism and commitment to God and His Spirit. And it happens by that Spirit being stirred up in us on a daily basis. It requires that every day we dedicate ourselves wholeheartedly, a full mind, body, and spirit, to this calling that we've been given, to seeking His kingdom and His righteousness. When we do these things, we will be given the gift that Paul talks about, one way all will enjoy. 2 Timothy 4, verse 8, I'll quote, "Now there is in store for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only me, but also to all who have longed for His appearing." Let us speed that day.